So April 24th, 1950, began the process of opening the claim between 1 and 1.5 million of units. It also took the lives of Greeks and Syrians. My purpose in this next hour, or less, is not to talk about the genocide per se, but to explore its root causes. I'm neither a scholar nor an expert on this, but I have read and I have thought a lot about this over many years, so I'm going to share my findings with you. I think it's a complex story, but my hope is that in painting this landscape, we'll have a better understanding of the events. It will require that we delve into history, geography, religion, culture, social structure, economics, social status, and human emotions surrounding notions of superiority, humiliation, envy, and entitlement. Oh my. You guys ready for the ride?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about Armenia. On this map over here, which most of you probably can't see, this is modern-day Turkey here, and this was the homeland of the Armenians. Now this flexes over time. It bulges, it flexes, it goes down here, but this is really kind of the heart and guts of Armenia, these provinces here. So for about 3,000 years, Armenia existed bordered by the Black Sea, Mediterranean, and Caspian Seas. Great powers rose and fell over the centuries, and the Armenian homeland, when not independent, was at various times ruled by Persians, Greeks, Romans, Byzantines, Arabs, Mongols, and Turks. Armenia is fixed on the earth at approximately in the low 40 degrees north latitude. 45 degree latitude runs through Roseville here. So, you know, right in the middle of big operations. 38 to 45 degrees, again flexing based on time and place, of east longitude. It is an arid land situated on a highland plain dominated by rugged, rough terrain, spotted with mountains, ravines, lakes, and rivers. Its climate is severe, experiencing cold and snowy winters and often hot, drought-prone summers. Kind of reminds me a little bit of the Dakotas. History, archaeology, and anthropology tell us that the Proto-Armenians, mostly the Hittite people, developed dry farming techniques there 6,000 years ago. This has an ancient history, this land formation, this high plateau. The Iron Age is launched in this area. And this is a locality as well as for the domestication of wheat, barley, sheep, cattle, pigs, and goats. A lot of stuff happening here. In the 11th century, the first Turkish tribes invaded Armenian homeland. Now the Turkish tribes come out of this Asian steppe land, they come down in here. They start moving in great numbers. Why? They must have had numbers. They must have had an explosion of population. They must have been inspired to go somewhere else, but they did. Thus began hundreds of years of rule by Muslim Turks. Seljuk Turks, tribes from Central Asia, poured into Persia in 1037. And captured Baghdad in 1055. And then defeated the Byzantine armies at Trastevere in 1071. And that's a big event, because at that particular point, that really kind of opens up occupation of Armenia by Muslims, by the Turkish tribes. The Seljuk Empire was at its height by the mid-12th century, when it was invaded by Mongols, which overran West Asia and ravaged Anatolia. So a wave of Turks, then the Mongols from Kurum, By mid-13th century, the Turks re-energized by tribal leader Osman, controlled much of southeastern Europe, and they moved into Western Asia, Northern Africa, and between the 14th and early 20th centuries, they controlled a great swath of territory. From here, all the way to here.
Again, across North Africa.
Yes. Egypt, Algeria, we know. After 1354, the Ottomans crossed into Europe with the conquest of the Balkans. It became a transcontinental, multilingual empire, some 30 nationalities or identifiable ethnic and language groups. Just a humongous thing. Think of the Roman Empire. This was kind of the same phenomena in the East. Just to throw some numbers out to help you think about it, from a population standpoint, in the year 1600, the Ottoman Empire comprised about 26 million people. Russia was 14 million people at this time. France, about 20 million people. Great Britain, 5.5 million. Just to give you a sense of the power of the Ottoman Empire in terms of just the population. By the way, in 1914, the Ottoman Empire had grown to just 35 million. Great Britain had surged to 46 million, France 41 million, Germany 68 million, Russia 166 million. Anybody know the population of Russia today? 143 million.
130 is what I would guess, but
yes, its population has shrunk. Okay, so we have this massive empire. Those who are holding pink cards, I'd like to know, why was the empire so successful? If you please, just raise your hand and tell me. Peter.
This
is pink. Oh, who's got pink? All right.
Well, I think one thing that...
Oh, sure.
Was highly centralized and power transferred to a single person who was ruled by a single family for seven centuries.
Yeah, so they were able to pull it all together, maintain it, and of course if there were any family members they thought were possible going to be in the continuance of the crown, they typically garrisoned and got rid of them. So they maintained their lines, they maintained their power, it was centralized. And they controlled them. Any other possible reasons why they were so successful? Jennifer?
United by Islamic ideology.
Okay, so they have a faith that they've adopted. And this faith is one that allows them to incorporate their understandings about who they are and who they're not. And this unifies them as well. Any other possibilities?
It says here, and it's true, created alliances across political and racial groups.
Yeah, they were very effective. When they came into a territory and they liberated it, they took it over, they would come to the people and say, you know, we're going to come in here. By the way, they went in with drums and cymbals. And that was the way of telling people, we're going to cause a lot of noise and ruckus. And we're coming. You better get ready. And, oh, by the way, how much does your lord now tax you? Really? Oh, our rate's going to be this. It's going to be less. And we won't burn your villages, we won't burn your towns if you agree to these deals. Okay? So they were very successful in incorporating people and not destroying them. They said, but you got to follow our rules.
The religion incorporated into the state structure. Sultan was the protector of Islam, ruthless in dealing with local leaders.
Yeah, so he said, okay, I'm it. I'm going to run this. I'm going to suppress anything that I don't like, and I will do it, and you'll lose your head. So anyway, there was no question about when the law was administered. It was brutal. Boom. No question about it. It's going to happen. So ruthlessness was a component. Any other factors?
Powerful military.
Yeah, they were a warrior race. They built a military that we were proud of and was very effective. Any other fact?
Pat Mike's military ethos pervaded the whole administration.
Yeah, so the military was the core. And this whole time running it, as long as you had that military in place, the rules would be carried out, no question about it. Any other factors? Yes?
Highly pragmatic, taking the best ideas from other cultures and making them their own.
Yeah, so, okay, Jews, Greeks, Armenians, okay, yeah, we can use that, We can give you some credit for that, but we'll take it. So they were open to those ideas. They were open to keep people in a survival mode, at least. So it's not hard to conclude that the Ottoman elite had a strong sense of superiority. You know, they built this engine, tremendous engine. It was challenging Europe constantly. It dominated a significant portion of the ancient world. Their armies had racked up successful conquests, one after another. They controlled Mecca, Medina, Jerusalem, Constantinople, holy sites of the three major world religions. And they controlled it. By the way, you know, the Holy Sepulchre, the Armenians have certain control on it and so forth. The Ottomans had given them that particular responsibility. They said, you get this, you get that. And in Jerusalem, the Armenians were treated pretty nicely by the Ottomans. They were, chits for things that they got. So their fierce and warrior nature was a major fear of Christian Europe. It was echoed by popes, Shakespeare, and Martin Luther. Martin Luther first said, "Don't resist the Turks." Scourge intentionally sent by God to sinning Christians. So this is the punishment. The people have been sinning, the popes have been sinning. This is what you deserve. And then he kind of changed his tune. And he said, he prayed for deliverance from the world, from the flesh, from the Turk, and from the devil. So the concept of the Turk was on the minds of Europeans. That this force was out there, this anti-Christian force was out there that would pressure them into things that they did not want to do. Now, the feeling of pride and dominance permeated the general Turkic Muslim population. And I think it even tinged the minorities. I mean, they got benefits out of this, the fact that this was a powerful empire. The minority groups were able to salvage some kudos out of this as well. While believers in Judaism and Christianity were seen as people of the book, they were subservient, I should say, to the final word of God through Muhammad, his last and greatest prophet. So, okay, you guys are part of the book, but you didn't get it right. You know, this is the last word. This is the right word. I will tolerate you, but really, you really should convert. Because this is, yeah, we agree, you know, Jesus, yeah, he was a great prophet. Oh, yeah, Moses, all this, but Muhammad, he's the top. Now, the empire codified and enforced the Ottoman Islamic State that it was in command and demanded obedience. Non-Turkish Muslims had less status than Ottoman Turks, but stood above Christian and Jews, Arabs, Kurds, Balkan Muslims, Circassians, Laz, Chechens, were often rebellious, but were respected for their faith, they were Muslim. The scriptures from the Quran form how to treat non-believers. The code applied to non-Muslims was called Dahimi. It afforded protection and rights with certain detailed restrictions and less than favorable tax systems. So if you were a non-Muslim, your tax rate is a little different. I understand they're trying to figure that out in the state of Minnesota right now. Paid a little additional money because of that. Now, under a system called milat, non-Muslim peoples were given limited power to regulate their own affairs. The system was applied to Greeks, Armenians, Assyrians, and Jews. And this was administered through their religious leaders. So the Armenian church would be responsible for meeting out justice, whether it was criminal, or it was had to do with economics. The church was the vehicle to settle these issues. Now, if it was between a Muslim and a Christian, the Muslim superseded that, and so it would then be held in a Muslim court. But if it was between Armenians, you guys, we don't want anything to do with it, you settle it. And that was the Millet system. So it worked fairly well for them. Now, these are the people with the violent cards now. Can you provide evidence of how non-Muslims were regulated by the Ottoman Empire? Any particular rules or regulations?
Non-Muslim men were barred from marrying Muslim women, and testimony by non-Muslim against Muslim was not accepted in court.
Okay, so Barb, Muslim, I couldn't marry Barb. She's a Muslim.
So you couldn't marry into the premier class?
No. Not unless you converted.
Could it work in reverse, though? Could a Muslim, no, I'm sure not.
Muslim man marry a Muslim, non-Muslim?
Yeah, they probably could.
You could.
Right?
You
yeah.
could. Yeah. That probably didn't happen very often, but I think you could. You could. Any other data?
Yeah, Jews and Christians were discouraged from living within a town or city's Muslim quarters.
So yeah, it was defined. You were segregated. Mm-hmm. What would that mean? But you were segregated, you could only live in a certain area. Now there were certain villages that probably broke down, but this was the law. And this was the law that was really enforced up until 1850, 1860, somewhere in there, and that started to break down. But remember, 95% of the Ottoman Empire in this area we refer to as Turkey, in this area which we concentrated on, was agrarian. We're talking small villages. We're talking trying, but really didn't change much.
Yeah.
So you might change things in Constantinople, Istanbul, but it's not going to be out here. Think about small town America. You're going to be more conservative. You're not going to change the structure because of the whims of Constantinople. So, any other data? Yeah.
In penal law, a Muslim who killed a non-Muslim was not obligated to be executed. You can get away with murder.
Yes. So I mean, this really begins to talk about status and the social structure. Who can do what? And what is codified? It's very strict. Any other guy? Yes?
Non-Muslim men, except priests, are not allowed to wear beards.
Anybody here with a beard? Yoakum. Well, Yoakum could do that if he comes in from Germany and lives in Pera, which is in Constantinople. He might be able to be allowed to wear a beard.
Has a mustache.
Mustache you can wear. Yeah. Okay, well, why would that be the case? No beard. Look at two things. You can identify very quickly, and it's a status thing, and the imams all have beards. No, the Armenian priests typically have beards too. They may have said, okay.
Yeah.
But the regular guys, no. Any other data? Yes?
Armenians were made to wear red shoes, grids black, and the shoes blue, and that went on until the 18th century.
Yeah. So you had costumes, especially Constantinople, you had to wear certain clothes. You couldn't just walk around. You had, what if you're Armenian, you wore blue shoes?
Red.
I was thinking of Memphis and blue shoes.
Yeah.
So red. I mean, obviously walking down the street, oh, I know who he is. Yeah. So everything's codified. Yes?
Christians and Jews were forbidden to wear clogs and had to attach bells to the coverings worn in the bathhouses.
Yes, so I can repeat it. You couldn't wear clogs into the bathhouses. Why? I mean, it made too much noise, I'm not sure. But then you also, on your covering coming in, you had to put bells on your cloth robe so you would announce that you're coming through, I guess, so that you get out of the way. So, you know, very strict understandings about what you're going to wear, how you're going to act. whether you're going to wear a beard, whatever else. Anything else?
Yes.
You could not build a home higher than all Muslims. And you had to have windows that did not look over into Muslim quarters.
So an architect would have to keep that in mind when building a house.
Yes.
Yeah. Bart.
Non-Muslims were prohibited from riding horses, from bearing arms, and were obliged to step aside for approaching Muslims.
Well, that's only reasonable, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, of course, the horse is a military device, really. Right? I mean, the Turkic tribes that came in here rode on horses, and were very good horse people. And to have a horse meant you had strength and you had the ability to control. So you didn't have a horse. So what did the Armenians have?
Donkeys,
and they had other Armenians. So they would carry stuff on their back.
Hamam.
Small point. At least some of those clothing or apparel restrictions went to the late 19th century.
Depending on, you're right. Depending on where you are. And I actually have pictures of that in here. So, whatever one's religion or ethnic status, life for the majority of the Ottoman subjects was pretty rough and traumatic. It didn't matter if you're Turk, Kurd, Armenian, it was tough. Most were engaged in subsistence farming. Most were tenant farmers, similar to serfdom relationships in Europe during the Middle Ages. Landlords rented plots to the farmers and shared in the risk benefits, mostly the benefits of the harvest. And it was a closed agrarian economy, whatever you grew and made, you probably utilized to stay alive. Now, whatever excess was bartered or sold in small villages. Craftsmen and traders were present in larger villages, performing their businesses and passing it from one generation to the next. Not much change occurred over the centuries. It was a pretty dire, down-to-earth existence. What little excess that did remain was sucked up by the central government. And then, of course, there was banditry and violence. They were constant threats in these small communities. And primarily, and you probably maybe want to resort, there's a pie chart piece in the handout, and you're going to get a sense of the population. This was about 1900, early 1900s. What you can see there is a pie chart, which gives you an understanding of the peoples who really occupy this thing that we refer to as Armenia. Okay? And probably all instances except maybe Van, Armenians are not the majority as a component. But if you look at the number of Armenians, let's say in Hezron, it looks like it's about less than, a little more than a third. But then you have Turks, you have Kurds, and then others. Who are the others? It could be Greek, they could be Chechens, they could be Jews, especially as you get up to the Black Sea, in that area here. There are more Jews up in here, and more Greeks, and more in cities. So, I have a National Geographic magazine dated October 1915. My dad bought this way, way back. But I want to read something here to you. What's my time, Jim?
You're okay.
We might go until about 7:30, is that right? This is a story written in October of 1915 by a woman by the name of Hester Donaldson Jenkins. I looked her up. This is an incredible person. She was born in 1869, died in 1941. She was born in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Oh, one of my cousins.
She's not a Armenian.
Well, I'm half
close. Oh, the truth comes out.
It's always been out.
She went to Oshkosh Normal School. Anybody know what a normal school is?
Teacher's College.
Then she goes to the University of Chicago, gets a PhD. Then she goes to Columbia University, gets another PhD, and becomes a professor of history and English, ends up at Constantinople College.
Wow.
She translated Turkish poems. She, of course, taught English, traveled throughout Turkey, and writes this article about Armenia. She was a Congregationalist and belonged to many, many academic societies. And for recreation, she liked riding, boating, and tennis. Incredible. So I just want to... Armenia is a word that has widely different connotations for different peoples. To us Americans, and this is 1915, it means a vague territory somewhere in Asia Minor. To the makers of modern maps, it means nothing. There's no such place to the Turks. A few years ago, it was a forbidden name, smacking of treason and likely to bring up that bugaboo nationalism, in which Abdul Hamid II feared nothing more unless it was liberty. But to nearly two millions of Russian, Persian, and Turkish subjects, it is a word filled with emotion, one that sends the hand to the heart and calls up pride and sorrow. So basically, Armenia is a non-entity then. And in fact, it's suppressed. We don't talk about it here. It's not part of our vernacular. She goes on, and I said there's some very interesting pictures in here, sort of photographs. But she does talk about typical towns. We've been talking about these places because I really want you to get a seeding of what these places were like. I mean, they're not urban, bustling towns with streetcars and stuff happening. They are pretty down-to-earth places. This is called typical towns. Typical Armenian town of the better class is Bardazik, near the coast, or near the Gulf of Nicomedia. This is a town of narrow streets paved with great stones and bordered by dark, narrow houses made of the unslaked brick of the scriptures. Anybody know what that means? Unslaked bricks?
And not fire.
This is the type of brick that the Jews were making, that Moses, and actually they weren't making in straw back then. That was a contention. The edges of the streets serve as gutters, and the doorsteps over them are littered with children. There is one schoolhouse, which is sort of a social center, serving as a lecture room or concert hall at need. There are, of course, the square Gregorian church. There is also a silk mill, and the fields are filled with mulberry trees wherein to feed the hungry silk. On the edge of the town are an English orphanage founded with the massacres of 1896. These are the Abdul Hamid II massacres. And an American college for boys, and the latter being the great center for enlightenment for the neighborhood. The fields are fertile and well tilled, but beyond them lies beautiful hills whence descend the marauding Kurds to reap where they have not sown. So I thought it was a pretty good capitalization of what it is to live in these little villages. Yeah?
When in 1915 was this written?
October.
There's no mention of
it. There is. There's pictures here of Armenians in ragged clothes. It's becoming known what's happening and so forth. But it's a remarkable story.
What's the town?
The town was...
Could you point on that map and where the towers?
I don't think I can. Just a little capitalization of what it was like for the majority of the people, whether they're Turk, Armenian, or Kurds. That's the way it was. Life was rough. But a fascinating story from a woman from Oshkosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did they? But I'm curious too,
that
the genocide was not mentioned.
Well, it is. In fact, here is a picture of Haji Agha, who I've read about in the past, he saved many, many Armenians. He was very helpful, especially to Europeans coming in to try to help in the Armenian cause. And he stepped up and said, this is wrong. So this was known, this was going on. But I think she was probably commissioned to do this story before this happened. You think about, you know, this coming out, where it was coming out, and so forth. And of course,
didn't know the extent of
what was going on. Yeah. I mean, she talks about the Abdul Hamid conspiracy. So.
Also, it was published in October, so
yes.
It was written.
Well, it was, you know, yes. Yeah. Now, while the Ottoman Empire calcified and struggled to evolve, as you can see, things aren't changing much. Europe emerged from its sleepiness of the Middle Ages, formulating and strengthening national, racial, and ethnic agendas. Grasping new ideas in philosophy, art, science, Europe began to really roar. Historians suggest that the Battle of Vienna in 1683 marked the turning point in which the Ottomans ceased to be a significant menace to Christian Europe. Okay? So the Ottomans wanted to take Venice, and almost did, earlier on. This is their last venture, 1683. They come up, they get repulsed. And how many like croissants? Yeah, I was going to bring some, but they didn't have enough. And I wouldn't have been able to feed the multitude.
Yeah.
The folklore is that the croissant was baked by the Venetians, or excuse me, the Viennese, in celebration of the defeat of the Turkish. Now, the croissant is what?
French.
Yeah, we say it, but what does croissant mean?
Crescent.
Crescent. And what is a crescent? It's a symbol of the Ottoman Empire.
Right.
So this is the notion. So next time you need a croissant, think about it.
Well, you think about it, crescent, but that's usually C-R-E,
yeah.
So, but croix is cross, so it's
C-R-I.
Almost
crossifying. But if you look at the look of a croissant,
yeah,
it doesn't look
true.
Like it.
It's
not a cross. So, within the declining power of the Ottoman Empire, the Armenians and others were able to carve out some advantages. Now, you got all these suppressive things happening. You can't do this, you can't marry a Muslim woman, you can't do this, you get that beard off, so forth. But Armenians, the Greeks, the Jews, they seem to somehow be figured out. So even under the long occupation, they were able to maintain their traditions while embracing new concepts and ideas and begin to better their lives and those who surround them. So I believe, this is my contention, that the Ottoman Empire actually did allow for this to happen. They provided some conducive elements here. To at least let these people live, maybe suck off some of the things that they did, but they were wise enough not to say, let's get rid of them, let's kill them, let's get away with their, they can't have their culture. They allowed them to have their culture, they allowed them to have their religion. Now, how many converted to Islam? I think quite a few. Okay. In my family history, the folklore, going back, they were in this part. At one point, before moving here, when they were in the Persian area, they had to disguise themselves as Muslims. And so part of the family began to kind of shift towards Islam. You know, after two or three generations, you say, well, I guess, who are we? Oh, we're Muslims. So I think there was absorption. There was violence and rape and everything else that was occurring too. So if you look at the Turkish population, you look at you might say, that looks like my family. There's not that much racially differing composition in these people. So, you have a blending of people. But the Armenians tend to do well. They're able to maintain these traditions. They then began to take a look at European ways. The Armenians were fascinated by that. They were more easily accepted by others. Many having been involved in trade and banking. They developed ties with Europe and elsewhere, and they exposed themselves to exciting new ideas. Now, in the Ottoman Empire, the Armenians were known as the Millet. I said Daka. That means the loyal elect. They were perceived to be the ones that were the most loyal. So ask yourself, why would that be the case? I have an idea.
Most long-term?
They were long-term. They sat in here, and their lives were not much different than most of the class that were in this. So they were, in fact, they talked, I mean, they spoke Turkish. They did commerce together, they did deals. I can tell you my great-grandfather was a landlord, and he had Kurds, Turks, and Armenians as tenant farmers. So they had to work together. You know, you butt up against the other guy's plot.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, we're going to figure it out. So there was a great deal of similarity in what they did and what they thought. So I think the Armenians were closer to the heart of what the Turks were than the Greeks. And they were called the Rums. R-U-M, Rums, as in ancient times, the Eastern Roman Empire. But the Greeks, as opposed to the Greeks that lived in Greece, if you lived in Turkey, you were called a Rum. R-U-M. Now, additionally, Armenians especially embraced the opportunities that mostly American Protestant missionaries offered in educating boys, girls, men, and women in new and thrilling ideas. Armenians raced to this. There were over 100 of these institutions in the Ottoman Empire. And the Armenians said, I want this stuff. So they started getting an education. They started getting imbued with European ideas, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, all these ideas, liberty. These things begin to infect the Armenian psyche. And one more thing from Hesiod. Americans, makers of Armenia. This is the earlier chapters. If the powers have done little for Armenians, powers being Europe, but raise false hopes, that is not true of the people of Europe and America. French missions are dotted all over Asia Minor. And German societies cared for children orphaned by the massacres, while English missions, schools, and orphanages attest a deep interest in the Armenians. But the greatest work done among them has been done by the Americans, whose schools and hospitals, say an Englishman, might almost be called the makers of modern Armenia. The American mission schools at Marsovan, Abdul Bazar, and scores of other places are filled with Armenians. And the men's colleges at Constantinople, Smyrna, Beirut, and elsewhere, and the women's college at Constantinople, which of course is women's, graduate each year numbers of intelligent Armenian men and women. So my contention is that the missionaries did much to improve a lot of the Armenians. But I think there are some consequences to that. So after centuries of, let's go to the green cards. What evidence do we have on hand that some Armenians met with high degrees of success in the empire? Yes?
Khalus Gulbenkian, one of the main advisors of the National Bank of Turkey. He headed Turkish Petroleum Company, which became Iraqi Oil, which eventually became Dutch Royal Shell.
Khalus Gulbenkian, yes. Powerful man. Basically, he's called Mr. 5%. So any oil that came out of that area, he got 5%. In addition to that, he helped to design where Iraq was going to be and Syria. And basically, he was the one that's carving up the Ottoman Empire. Any other people? Yes, Jim.
Yeah, there's an Armenian Catholic family, the Druzians. Mr. Druzian was appointed as superintendent of the Imperial Mint in 1757 to 1880. Most of the employees of the mint were Armenian. The records were kept in Ottoman, but in the Armenian alphabet. which few except Armenians could read. The Druzian family was also the keepers of the Sultan's jewels.
So there must have been a certain amount of trust here, right? So you got an Armenian running your national bank, keeping your jewels, and the records are in Armenian script in Turkish language. Anybody else? Yeah.
The Dadian family controlled the munitions industry in the empire. Halust Gulbenkian, main advisor to the Nazis.
See what I wrote. Yes.
Well, there were more ties to banking as well, and the Armenians replaced the Jews as the chief bankers in Constantinople. This was between 1770 and 1840. And they would finance the provincial governors who were scattered around the countryside. So they sort of had a network of ways to communicate with them.
So you're going to play with these bankers,
yeah,
right? Otherwise, you're not getting any money out to this far off distant. And I'm wondering, you know, if you get an Armenian out there, and maybe a bishop as well, might have some persuasive power in getting new money in this particular area.
I identified interest rates ranging from 18% to 24%.
Oh,
that could make it interesting.
Well, as you know, the Quran, you cannot charge.
Yeah.
You cannot charge interest on this. So, it's one way for the Ottoman Empire to handle it, right? Any other? Yes.
Five generations of the Balian family designed and constructed major buildings for the Ottoman Empire. Such examples are the Dolmabahce Palace and many mosques.
So this is a case in point where the Ottoman said, hey, you got the talent, we're gonna use it. You know how to do this? We're gonna do it. Any other information? Okay, so you get a sense. I didn't put Sinan in there because his ethnicity is somewhat in doubt. But Sinan was a great architect as well. And he probably was Armenian. I'm getting a 5-minute warning.
10 minutes.
Okay. So you get, after centuries of running up victory after victory, the Ottoman Empire gets exhausted. Its economy begins to falter, even shrink. Its perceived enemy in the Christian Europe grew even stronger. Once proud Ottomans endured one humiliation after another. And Europe began drooling over the prospects of the sick man of Europe. It was a term used back then, turn of the century. This thing is going to fall apart. We really did our fair share of this. Russia, Britain, France, Austro-Hungarian Empire, Germany, and others saw opportunities in the remnants of the decaying Ottoman Empire. Adding to its misery was the emergence of national movements in its own territory. So you got these people thinking, oh, I'm not an Ottoman, I'm a Serb. I'm not an Ottoman, I'm a Greek. I'm Albanian. I'm an Arab. As well as some Armenians even thinking about that notion of nationalism. Each defeat to a European power in battle, resulting in treaties favorable to the winner, and usually forcing concessions on the Ottoman Empire. And those concessions oftentimes were to ease it up on the Christian minorities. So you can see how resentment begins to build. What do you mean we're going to have to treat these people differently? What are you doing to us? So humiliation turns to anger, and that anger was sharpened by the empire's Christian minorities who were seen in league with these external powers. So there's this relationship. And Britain saying, you better not do this. And France is coming in and saying, Catholic Armenians, you better not mess with them. You get all these forces. So the Serbs are the first ones that test this out in 1840. Over there. Then the Greeks, of course, Lord Byron gets involved in this in the 1820s, and you start seeing this shattering in the Balkans. This is where a tremendous amount of their wealth sits in the Balkans. This is the European section of the Ottoman Empire. Great deal of wealth. That begins to recede, they lose control of it, and they shrink back here. So, are they mad? Are they upset? Yeah. Then we have nationalist thought growing within the Ottoman Empire itself. They became enchanted with the emergence of an idea of Turkification. Realizing the old Ottoman concept of empire was over and that more concise national identity would need to be shaped out of this old empire. So they have to reconfigure, they have to say, well, this thing isn't working, we have to do something different. And at first, the Young Turks, you've probably heard of the term Young Turks, were intellectuals intrigued with Western ideas. They come out of the Balkans, basically, these guys. As well as Kendall Adams. This is where the brains come out of the Ottoman Empire these days. And they saw that this was not going to work. As time wore on, they saw the cause too immense and the ideas too hard to translate into a faltering empire. The Young Turks began to evolve to more nationalist theme, Turkey for Turks, as the end of the 20th century. Now, we have this little incident in the Balkans. Archduke Ferdinand is off on a parade. He takes the wrong turn. We have this young Serbian princep. Out of the corner of his eye, he sees the car turning and he shoots him dead. And of course, that's the powder keg that starts all of these alliances, start to us in the Great War. Now, the Committee of Union of Progress is the one that kind of forms out of the Young Turks. And they decide it was time to act to eliminate the internal war threat. They saw, there they have a Christian, not a majority, but there's quite a few here. And that's a problem. They have a nation that they have people, they have Russians. The Russians are advocating that the Armenians, in their part of the section, they could do something different. Maybe they shouldn't be in the Ottoman Empire. Maybe they should be in their cause. Maybe they can help the Armenians. So you have the Armenians in that sector in the eastern provinces beginning to think about, we should get out of the Ottoman Empire. Not great numbers, but enough to get the ire of the Ottomans and the Young Turks. So anybody ever see the movie Lawrence of Arabia? It's my favorite film. This explains a lot about the Ottoman Empire. Get to see it's fascinating. The solution was to depopulate the regions with high concentrations of Armenians, constituting more, no more than 10%. If you can drive the populations down to the 10% range, we might be able to assimilate them, absorb them, or eventually eliminate them. If we get it down, we're all right. So let me just ask you this. You know what the percentage of the population was in the Ottoman Empire in 1950? Armenians? It's under 10%. It was under 10%. It's probably about 7%. But in this region, it's varied as the map will show you, 40, 30, 20, whatever. So this was the problem. So, by the way, anybody know what the African American population is currently in the United States?
Oh.
About 12%. You know where it was during the Civil War? About the same. That's a change. Well, South Carolina is the majority of that.
Yeah.
Not
then,
now.
No, back then.
Yeah. You're aware of our own issues here in this country with Native Americans, and you know, Jefferson's plan for the Native Americans was assimilation. They're small enough people, and eventually we'll intermarry or we'll eliminate them. We'll take care of that problem. And blacks were a bigger issue. What can you do with them? You know what Lincoln's solution was? Repatriation to Africa.
Liberia.
And, Liberia was the test case. And Frederick Douglass comes up to Lincoln and says, how can you do this? My people have been here longer than yours. What do you mean? That's not a, look, you're here. But he had pleaded firmly that the two races could not exist together. at least at that particular point. We've even gone to thoughts about maybe making Alabama and Mississippi black states. Sounds similar, you know, in some ways. Let's drain these areas here, take them down here. They're desert areas, so what? But we'll take them down off the high plain, put them down there. They can survive. They're pretty wily people. Let's get them out of there. Drain it. Solve the problem. So, now, the solution, 10%. They engaged local people. It wasn't really a big military operation. The military was really engaged in Gallipoli. They were engaged against French, Syria. They were in Baghdad. The British were coming in Baghdad. They had big issues. But they engaged the local populations emotionally. And first of all, you have chaos. Crops aren't coming in. People are getting hungry. There's destitute feelings. And the Armenians have something to say. They begin to put away. And the government begins to say, these people are dishonest. These people are really, truly not citizens any longer. They're talking with Russia. And we need to make them pay. So they morph this emotional frenzy into a holy cause. It's a just killing. If you're going to take their property, they deserve it. Now, I'm going to go back to the year 620. Muhammad's followers have been told to destroy a caravan that's outside of Mecca. This is a retribution by Muhammad on some of his foes. And the Quran says you're not supposed to kill. Just like the Christian Bible, you're not supposed to kill. But he says, Muhammad's followers, after having been told to destroy a caravan outside Mecca, said, it was not you who slew them, but Allah who slew them, the Prophet. So if you're doing it for Allah, you're not guilty. So by incorporating religion in its ethos and its edict, you're able to emotionally engage these people who see the Armenians a little bit better lifestyle. And why are they better than us? How can this be? We have a superior religion. There's something wrong. And then you have mountain Kurds who periodically come down and raid villages anyway because that's what you did. So they were engaged as well. So, I'm going to wrap it up here. But if you look at geographies, it says a lot about the situation. If you look at religion, it says a lot about the situation. If you look at the depth of history, 6,000 years, and eventual wave after wave of invasions and submission to other peoples, you see a social status, a structure that you're less than another human being. You have economic disparities. You have ideas from the Enlightenment that light you up in your community, but are distrusted by others. And then you have chaos of war layered on top of all this. And then emotional engagement. You're an enemy. You do not deserve to live in this place. Get the hell out. So I'd also enter another word called destiny. Maybe you've heard of the word manifest destiny, which was a term used by in American history, that it was our destiny to go from coast to coast. But what was in the middle of that area? Who were the people who were in the middle that were interfering with our destiny? Some similar situations, and this is true throughout history. If you're in the way, you either have to move you or kill you. You don't fit our concept. And that's kind of what happened. Now, I'm going to finish with this. My brother and I went to Istanbul in 1998. And it's a city that my grandmother was from Karakoy. It's right across on the bridge. There's an Armenian church there, which is quite interesting. It had barbed wire around it. This is what it says in the Fedor's Exploring Turkey. Ethnic minorities. Historically, Turks have distanced themselves from the Jews, Armenians, and Greeks living in their country, viewing them as minorities that cannot be assimilated regarded as crafty ones. The three ethnic groups are ranked in order by a Turkish proverb. One Greek can cheat two Jews. One Armenian can cheat two Greeks. Significantly, Turkey's record on tolerance of Jews has been good, while its treatment of the so-called super crafty Armenians has been the worst. 1998, Fedoris traveled. Now, today, you still have that sentiment in Turkey. Erdogan was accused of having Armenian blood, and it enraged him to be insulted such. So there's this feeling that these people are subhuman. This has been embraced. Now, in your handouts, I have general information which we're going to look at later. And then there's some terms, some general information. Point out the term Turk, even to the Turk, was a derogatory term. And it was really basically resurrected. A Turk was someone who was out in the province digging in the ground. So it could be an Armenian, too. And it was a low life. You were an Ottoman if you really were in the elite. So yeah, some of that's kind of interesting. One thing I found really interesting was when Constantinople had been captured in 1453, the effect of this on the Christian Europe was enormous. One unexpected effect was that many scholars fled from the new empire to Italy, where they were influential in sparking the Renaissance, increasing trade with the East. Excuse me. Muslim dominance of the trade scene in the former Constantinople increased pressure on Western nations to find new ways to the East by going westward. This eventually led to the expeditions of Columbus, Magellan, and Drake. Now, this is one perspective. I don't know how much influence, but it's a brain drain from Constantinople. Where are you going to go? Well, Venice is a natural route. Florence, dump some of that information there. Kind of an interesting thought. The Armenians suffered when the trade routes were opened up because they had some control of trade coming this direction, silk and so forth and so on. But once Western Europe had found another way to get to the East, Armenians suffered. So, any questions? I put this article here on the back. Turkish region recalls massacre of Armenians. And this is the heart of Armenia. Harput, Elazar, and so forth. But I wanted to read something. Tied this to my meeting. Should I highlight it?
The third paragraph?
Oh, here it is. One of the foreigners was an American consul, Leslie Davis. He wrote out on a trip to Lake Hazar. Lake Hazar, at that particular time, was called Lake Udruk. After the massacres, thousands and thousands of Armenians, mostly helpless women and children, were butchered on its shores and barbarously mutilated in the inner book. The wine name, Keljik, is Udruk. So that's where my name comes from. In any case, it goes on, and the Turks that are there say, we know what happened. People that see the bones and so forth, they know what happened, but it's not going to be exposed. Anyways, thanks so much for listening.
Thank you.